And you tuned into Morning Edition on KASU Jonesboro. Good morning, I'm Mark Smith. With me on the phone this morning is First District Congressman Rick Crawford. Good morning, Congressman.
Hey, how are you?
Doing well. Good to have you with us this morning. Of course, we've been closely monitoring the threats that are being made by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Been paying a lot of attention to this in the news. What's your threat assessment?
Well, you know, I think that's something that is probably on everybody's mind. I mean, there's also, you know, the reality is, is he just blustering? Does he really have the technology? And are we willing to gamble that he doesn't? So I think it's something that we have to take seriously, but don't try to validate this guy any more than we have to. I think he's doing a little saber rattling to try and get some attention, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we just dismiss it. I mean, there's a lot of people that might think, well, you know, it's like a kid that's acting out. If you just ignore him, he'll stop it. I don't know about that. And the other thing is, you know, the threat that he presents to the immediate area, for example, South Korea and potentially Japan, those are key allies. Obviously, we have agreements with them, and we need to be diligent to make sure that he doesn't pose a threat to our friends in the region.
Well, let's talk some budget issues. The president, of course, has delivered his budget after the House and Senate passed their respective budgets. So we've gone from not having a budget at all to having three budgets. How do you juggle all these budgets now?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I guess we've got all these deficits, but what we don't have is a deficit in budgets. We have surplus budgets. It's going to be hard to reconcile three of them. You know, unfortunately, it took him 65 days past the due date to do it. But and you know, the other thing is just looking at the numbers, over $3.7 trillion in spending, with another almost $750 billion in deficit spending, and over $500 billion in new taxes, $200 billion in new spending cuts divided equally between defense and non-defense programs. So. You know, and as I said, on top of all that, the budget was 2 months late. So I think we would probably have had an easier time trying to reconcile this if all things had come together in a timely fashion. But, you know, bottom line, I just don't think this budget of the president's is going anywhere.
Well, can you reconcile the House and Senate budgets?
I think that's going to be equally difficult. I think they've staked out a pretty hard position that has a call for a considerable increase in revenues. And I don't think that's a realistic approach given the fiscal environment that we have here in the federal government. So, you know, I think, again, what I have been advocating strongly for is permanent spending controls. I'll continue to do that because whatever budget we come up with, if there's no underlying enforcement mechanism, then it's a non-binding resolution. And what we need to do is worry about getting control of Congress and making Congress behave and spending appropriately and acting accordingly. And I think the only way we do that is either through a balanced budget amendment or a spending limitation amendment that forces Congress to act responsibly.
Well, is it realistic to expect significant enough spending cuts that you don't need any extra revenue?
Well, yeah, I think that extra revenue, we've done extra revenue. And I think that we've demonstrated good faith by doing that as a body. And then the president comes back to the table and the Senate comes back to the table with even more revenue increases. I don't think that's a balanced approach at all, even though they like to talk about a balanced approach. I don't think that represents a balanced approach. I think we you know, the House of Representatives did go along with a revenue increase. Now I think it's time to start talking about the real problem, and that's our spending problem and this debt spiral that we're in.
Well, you know, spending cuts, of course, are difficult. They're not easy things to come up with, and you want significant spending cuts. We've heard the phrase many times, everybody takes a haircut. It requires tough decisions. So what... Can you name what you're willing to give up in Arkansas or in the First District to help solve what you see as the nation's debt problem?
Well, you know, we've already demonstrated that, particularly, you know, we talk about agriculture being the number one industry in Arkansas. It's more so in the First District. And we've demonstrated that we're willing to implement some pretty deep cuts to the farm bill and the commodity title. Farmers said, we understand that we're going to have to take some cuts and we're going to have to retool farm policy and the money associated with it. And that was done in a big way, and we'll continue to be looking at that. But we can't balance the budget by simply looking at ag spending and conservation spending and so on. There has to be a broader approach. And so everybody does have to be willing to, you know, put their cards on the table and say, here's what we can sustain. And if, while this is all going on, you know, we have groups coming in all week long, all month long, and, you know, through the entire first quarter asking for more money. You know, so, you know, everybody says, cut all you can, just don't cut me. You know, that's not realistic. We know we have to cut. We've demonstrated an ability and willingness to do that on the ag side. We're just asking everybody to come to the table. And whatever demographic or constituency or special interest you represent, understand that we're all going to have to get in the game here and make some sacrifices. And, you know, some are probably going to sacrifice more than others. Bottom line is, though, we're all going to have to do it for the future of the country.
Gun legislation has been a big topic this week over in the Senate. There was a deal that two senators reached on background checks. Does this deal matter? Is it going anywhere?
Well, you know, it'll go somewhere in the Senate. I mean, it'll go to the floor. Now, it remains to be seen. They'll take 2 weeks to debate it, and it remains to be seen what the fate of that particular legislation is in the Senate. As far as the House, I don't see it ever coming to the floor on the House side.
Why is it background checks is what this particular deal was all about? Why is it considered unreasonable to require background checks for selling someone a gun?
I don't think it's considered unreasonable. I think what they're trying to do with expansion of background checks and then talking about assault bans, assault weapons bans, and you know, high capacity magazines and so on, none of those things would have made a difference in these shootings that we typically talk about, most recently the one that happened in Connecticut. And most people have acknowledged that wouldn't make a difference, wouldn't have made a difference. So I don't see any point in focusing on that when we really need to take a different approach to, you know, how we look at these type of incidents and what we do to prevent them in the future. And you know, we already have background checks. And so, you know, that would not have mattered. Even these expanded background checks would not have caught the shooter at Newtown or Aurora, Colorado, that would not have made one bit of difference. And so if we're going to try to make a difference, are we doing this because we're trying to make ourselves feel better and we're trying to make a statement to the American people that we feel your pain, or are we doing it because it genuinely does make a difference? And I think what we need to be focused on is trying to find an approach to this that genuinely does make a difference, and it's not about headlines and feel-good political stances, but it's meaningful. And I just don't see that that's the case here.
So what would make a difference in your opinion?
Well, I think what we need to do is recognize, you know, what the commonalities are among these perpetrators here. And they all had mental health problems. And they didn't have criminal backgrounds. They had mental health problems. And so let's focus on the mental health component here. And what do we do to identify these folks? And we've already seen, heck, there's one reporter right now that's about ready to go to jail because she won't reveal the source, how she found out that the shooter in Aurora had communicated his intent to commit these acts to his mental health professional. Now, the mental health professional, obviously there's doctor-client privilege. Right. However, there's also a moral obligation when someone presents a danger to himself or others that mental health professionals do have a reporting requirement. So why this one fell through the cracks, I don't know. But that's one of the things that we have to examine. The other thing is when we talk about trying to get a handle on things like background checks and so on, criminals will use guns regardless of what the laws are. We see that all the time. So if we're using the argument that, well, this will help us identify the criminals, no, it won't, because criminals don't subject themselves to background checks. That's why they're criminals. So again, what we're really focusing on, and the police will tell you the same thing. If you look, there was a poll that was released yesterday that just staggering numbers of police. I think they polled 15,000 active police officers, and the numbers were vastly bear this out, that these criminal background checks that are being talked about in the Senate right now would not have had an effect on either of these issues, either of these incidents, whether it be in Colorado or Connecticut. And so, again, look at the commonalities here. Any of these high-profile shootings that have taken place recently, they're all a mental health issue. They're not a criminal background issue. And so we need to focus on what the real problem is.
Here in Jonesboro, many communities around the country, we have an active school resource officer program. Schools used to get federal grants to help pay for these school resource officers, but now they have to foot the whole bill or just delete the program. I know this is an era of budget cuts, but doesn't this seem like it would be a good investment in protecting our kids?
Well, and here's the thing, is that the Safe Schools Act came out as a direct response to the Westside shooting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, Westside was one of, in a series that had taken place up to that point, that finally legislators said, well, we need to do something. We need to find a way to fund some programs that will protect these kids. So the Safe Schools Act came about. And it wasn't just about school resource officers. It was also about placing mental health professionals in the school to provide mental health services, to do just what we were talking about, to try to find, do early identification, early detection of those young people who may be a risk to perpetrate these kinds of acts. And so it wasn't just about school resource officers. The program gave the schools the flexibility to either take the grant to use for a school resource officer or a school social worker or a combination of the two, and many schools did that. Mm-hmm. And in Jonesboro, what you see in most of the schools in Craighead County have a school resource officer, maybe two, maybe three, depending on the school. And they will also have a number of school-based mental health providers. And I'm talking about master-level mental health professionals. And so some of these are paid for by the school, but most of them are third-party contractors who see children, and then there's a Medicaid component to that. They're not there on grants anymore. The only grant component now is geared toward the school resource officer. And in most cases, that money's not there either. And so what you see is the cities are just saying this is a worthwhile program. So what we're going to do is essentially deploy one or two or three of our officers to a given campus for that school year. And when they're not on that campus during the school year, then they're a regular patrol officer doing whatever, when the school year is not in session. So what we see is municipalities that have stepped up and recognized the value that they bring to the table in terms of helping to add to the school security program. But there's also some other things that need to be taken into consideration. That's physical security, the protocols for having visitors on campus and so on. And those are all being aggressively investigated and trying to be incorporated, particularly in schools that are engaging in new construction. And I think there are schools that are also trying to go back and see what they can do to sort of retrofit to enhance their physical security, as well as the human component, that is the school resource officers, and then the mental health component, which are your school-based mental health therapists.
Well, it seems like all the action on the hot button topics have been mainly on the Senate side lately. What's been going on in the House? Looks like we've had a lot of hearings.
Well, we've had some hearings. We're preparing, hopefully within the next 2 to 3 weeks, to start marking up a farm bill. We're going to vote today on an NLRB appointment issue that you've probably seen some of the headlines where NLRB appointments were made while Congress was in session. So they were considered recess appointments, and it turns out that even the D.C. Circuit Court here, federal court, said that that was unconstitutional. However, they've decided they're going to ignore that decision. So we've had to take action here in the House to make sure that the executive branch doesn't dismiss the fact that the legislative branch is a co-equal branch, and we should not be dismissed and really run roughshod over, basically. So this is sort of a reaffirmation of what the lower court upheld as unconstitutional, and we suspect that this will not be the end of this issue.
Well, I know you and some other House members are introducing a bill to reform the renewable fuel standard known as the RFS. What's wrong with the RFS, and what does the legislation propose to fix it?
Well, right now the RFS mandates about 36 billion gallons of renewable fuels go into our nation's fuel supply. Right now, almost all of that is being fulfilled by corn ethanol. Now, I'm not trying to bash corn ethanol. However, in 2011, we had 5 billion bushels of corn used for ethanol. That's about 40% of the U.S. corn crop. Now, when you take 40-plus% of the national corn crop out of the food chain and put it into the fuel chain, you're gonna cause some problems. Most notably, you're seeing an increase in prices in food, so your market basket goes up. And not just for the direct corn products, certainly that's an issue, but what we sometimes don't think about is that bacon, pork chops, milk, eggs, and chicken and beef that you buy at the grocery store, all of that comes from being, fed corn in the protein sector. Mm-hmm. And if the price of corn goes up to the protein sector producer, that cost is going to be reflected at the grocery store, so our market basket of goods goes up. So the food versus fuel debate is not going away. I'm not anti-renewable. However, we have come together in a bipartisan way and recognize that the RFS is doing more harm than good. Not only is it exacerbating the problem of high food prices, but it's also creating damage to engines. I mean, we're seeing this more and more. Marine engines, small engines like two-stroke engines and so on that lawn care people use. It's causing more damage even to your regular car engine. The mileage is not what it was projected to be. There's just a whole lot of reasons why we need to rethink this position on renewable fuel standard. And if the marketplace demands it, I'm all for it. I'm all for those market-driven solutions. And if renewable fuels fits the bill in terms of ethanol, then I say let's go straight forward with it. But what we have here is a scenario where the government is making this mandate and picking winners and losers while the marketplace is rejecting it. And we're seeing, I mean, heck, all you got to do is drive through our district, Mark, and you'll see the signs up that the gas stations say our premium contains no ethanol. That's because people don't want to buy fuel with ethanol in it. And the federal government's saying you've got to carry this blend. So they carry it, but now they're advertising because people want to know where they can get fuel that doesn't contain ethanol. And so what we're seeing is actually the opposite happening in the marketplace, where the market is rejecting ethanol, and the federal government is saying, no, we're going to mandate an RFS, a renewable fuel standard, of at least 10. In fact, the EPA would like to increase that to 15. And not only would that inflict damage in the protein sector, it would also create a major problem for retailers who have to go in and now get new equipment to pump E15. That would cost billions of dollars across the country, and guess who picks up the tab? Not the retailer. In the short term, the retailer writes the check to pay for the new equipment. But ultimately, the cost is spread out over the cost of a gallon of gas, and so you and I pay for that at the pump.
Well, just very quickly, Arkansas was the site of a major oil spill a couple of weeks ago. It led to a lot of questions about the risks of pipelines, like the proposed Keystone XL pipeline.
Yeah, and I hope that that's not used as an excuse to say no to the Keystone pipeline. I think this is, we've got pipelines crisscrossing this country, and there's nothing new about us moving petroleum products through pipelines. This was an unfortunate incident. And I regret that it happened, but it cause and effect, it has no relation to whether or not we ought to go forward with the Keystone Pipeline.
All right, got to wrap you up. Thank you for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Mark.
Arkansas 1st District Congressman Rick Crawford joining us from his office in Washington. You're listening to Morning Edition on KASU.